A blue letter M slides across a black background, revealing glinting gold letters which spell Miramax. The words Home Entertainment appear underneath. Behind the words, a huge black M is silhouetted against blue light. Australian Film Finance Corporation, in association with Pandora Cinema, South Australian Film Corporation, British Broadcasting Corporation and Film Victoria, present a Momentum Films production, a Scott Hicks film. A man's face appears in profile.
I did. I thought it was a cat. Ooh. Well, kind of. I identified with cats, but I kind of did that. I wonder what that was. His name is when you try to strike them, is that right? So maybe I was a sad cat. Was I a sad cat? Because I wonder. Yeah, I wonder about cats. Truly, I did. Because they're always a fatty daddy. Kiss them all. Always kiss cats, always did. If a cat let me kiss it, I'd kiss it. You know, if I see a cat in the fence, I'd kiss it. Always, I will, didn't I?
Bright white letters spell shine. Smaller letters spell Armin Mullistahl, Noah Taylor, Jeffrey Rush, Lynn Redgrave, Googie Withers, Sonia Todd, Nicholas Bell, and John Gielgud. Night. Rain splashes down a window. Outside is a glow of hazy blue light.
Ooh. Life's a perpetual risk, isn't it? That's right, I think it is. Because the point is, I was different in that sense. I've got to be different again. But can a leopard change its spots? Who knows? Ooh. It's a blood sport. I think it's a blood sport. It's true. It seems to be true. Or is it a blank? Bit of a scrabble. Oh, you've got to put all the pieces together, see if you can make a word. Oh, that's funny. It's a mystery.
The man appears again. Lines on his face suggest that he's in his 40s. He peers in through a plate glass window, and a flashing red light makes his face blaze. The colour fades to pale pink as he backs away, watching intently. White and blue light glistens on the dark body of a car, splattered with raindrops. The man hurries along a street, squinting up through his glasses, a damp cigarette clenched between his teeth. He rushes to a restaurant window. Inside, a man rises from a piano. The pianist and a waitress move to the bar. Blue neon light flickers on a fish tank in the restaurant, glowing on the man's hands as he raps on the window. The pianist looks round from his perch at the bar and waves his hand dismissively. The man rushes from window to door and raps at that. A waiter opens up, leaning against the door frame, blocking the entrance.
What's the problem, mate? Sorry, mate. I'm the problem. Oh, such a problem. I'm a wet hole. But it's not an ideal world. Is it an ideal world? I mean, we just have to make the most of it. This is the way we find it, isn't it? Yeah. But I mean, it's more ideal than it was because we're privileged. We're privileged, aren't we? Because not long ago, people would be burned to a stake, wouldn't they, Moby? Maybe.
No, yeah.
Tony, not Moby. Tony. Who am I, Tony? Who knows, Tony? I don't know myself. I'm David, Tony. How does it sound?
Hi, David. How can Sylvia help?
Sylvia, pleased to meet you, Sylvia. Schubert, wasn't it? He said, who is Sylvia? What is she?
Of course he did. What can we do for you, David?
I've got to stop talking. It's a problem, isn't it?
No, it's all right. You just tell Sylvia why you're here.
Oh, well. It's a mystery.
Are you lost?
It's a mystery. Am I lost? I'm sexy?
Yes.
I'm lost. How does that sound? Yes. Oh, is that your piano, Sylvia? Beautiful Sylvia. Oh, this is Sylvia, beautiful Toby. Not Toby, Tony. You're beautiful too, Tony. Oh, perhaps I could play it. Could I play it? You say, like hell, baby.
Go on.
Shut up, Sam.
Hell, baby. Whoa, the devil, the diablerie.
Sylvia, could I play?
That's very important, isn't it? Multi. But then again, it's a lifelong struggle, isn't it, Sylvia? Tony, Sylvia, to survive undamaged and not to destroy any living, breathing creature. I mean, the point is, if you do something wrong, you can be punished for the rest of your life. So I think it's a lifelong struggle. Is it a lifelong struggle?
Yeah.
I mean, whatever you do, I think it's a struggle. The struggle to keep your head above water and not get it chopped off. I'm not disappointing you, Sylvia, Tony.
Sam, yes, Sam. Tony drives David and Sylvia away in a red Jaguar.
Sorry, Sylvia, I sound like a doggy. Help God, with the help of God. That's what it means, Sylvia. How's that? You see, Daddy's daddy was religious, very strict, and a bit of a meanie. But he got exterminated, didn't he? So God didn't help him. It's not very funny. It's very sad, really. I'm callous, Daddy said, callous, and a bit of a meanie. Sorry, Sylvia, I'm not damaging you. I mustn't damage Sylvia. The point is, perhaps I haven't got a soul.
What makes you say that?
Daddy said so. He said there's no such thing as a soul.
Oh, that's ridiculous.
Ridiculous, you're right. I'm ridiculous, Sylvia, Tony. And callous, Daddy said, callous. Ridiculous and callous. because it was a tragedy. A tragedy. Ridiculous tragedy.
A man stands on the platform of a school hall. Children, neatly dressed in the clothes of the 1950s, crane their necks towards the back of the hall. Young David, about 8 years old, in grey jacket and bow tie, walks nervously up the central aisle, murmuring to himself. The man, standing beside a trestle table with four silver cups on it, claps enthusiastically as David joins him.
David's going to play the piano for us, aren't you, David?
Yes.
What are you going to play? David? David, what are you going to play?
Excuse me. Chopin, the Polonaise.
At the back of the hall, a balding man with glasses and a moustache stands for a moment. David arranges his music and sits on the piano stool, pulling it closer to the upright piano. Three judges are sitting at a paper-strewn table. The male judge closes his eyes and wearily rests his head in one hand. The little boy sits motionless for a moment, then raises his hands to the keyboard. Is away from David, who drags the stool closer again.
It's a piano.
The man scurries from the back of the hall to the master of ceremonies.
It's a disgrace.
This kid's good. He's great.
He's my son.
David's father marches grimly along a suburban street. David follows a few paces behind. The lad hopscotches through squares chalked on the pavement. A girl perched in a tree watches David and his father approach.
Here they come. Did he win or lose? Margaret!
He lost. Now we'll cop it.
David runs a few paces to keep up with his father. Inside, David is sitting at the big kitchen table, frowning over a game of chess. Behind him, his mother kneels in front of an old-fashioned range, trying to light it. His father stands, hands in pockets, in front of the fireplace. David moves a piece.
It's your turn. Huh? It's your turn, Daddy.
Daddy sits opposite David.
Let me see. You're losing. David, always win. Always. When I was a boy your age, I bought a violin, a beautiful violin, and I saved for this violin. And you know what happened to it?
Yes, he smashed it.
Yeah, he smashed it. David, you're a very lucky boy. My father never let me have music.
I know.
You're a very lucky boy. Say it.
I'm a very lucky boy.
Very lucky.
Now shall I play for you?
No, pick up this piece.
Margaret, hunched over a book at the other end of the table, watches David pick up the chess pieces. Their father walks to a gramophone, lifts the white plastic needle arm, and carefully lowers it onto a black vinyl LP.
I bet I could have won.
You'd have been too scared.
Shh! Their father sits in an armchair by the gramophone.
David! Listen.
Mother looks up and Margaret stands.
Margaret, I told you, tell your friends not to come.
Margaret slumps back into her chair, chin in hand. Outside, the male judge, a man with dark hair, a small beard and moustache, and wearing a brown suit and bow tie, walks past the corrugated iron wall of the house and peers over a trellis fence.
Hello.
David's little sister leads the judge into the kitchen.
Hello. I hope I'm not interrupting.
David's father turns off the gramophone.
Ben Rosen, I was one of the judges.
Yes?
You left before all the prizes were announced. You were very good this afternoon, David.
Thank you.
He can play better.
Well, maybe he was a little too good. Some people don't like that. We gave him a special prize for his courage.
Rosen offers an envelope to David. His father takes the envelope and slips it into his cardigan pocket.
It's a difficult piece you chose, David.
Daddy chose it.
Well, even great pianists think twice before tackling the Polonaise.
Prize for losing.
I wouldn't call him a loser.
Ja, das genug.
Sie spielt aber gut.
Margaret, seated at the piano, stops playing.
They all play.
I'm quite sure David could win lots of competitions with the right tuition. My card.
I teach you.
Yeah, you've obviously done very well.
Yeah, no one taught me. No music teachers. Mr. Rosen.
No, of course. It's just a few bad habits can sometimes mean the difference between winning or losing. Oh, perhaps you'd like to think about it.
David's father backs Rosen through the door and closes it. Rosen bangs his thigh in frustration. Night. The house gleams silver in the moonlight. Shadows of trees sway across the walls. Inside, David's father steps out of his bedroom, pulling on a red check dressing gown. He pauses outside the kitchen, smiling, then enters. David is sitting on the double piano stool. There is no music in front of him.
Rachmaninoff.
That's beautiful.
You taught yourself?
From the record.
It's very difficult. It's very difficult.
He sits beside David at the piano.
It's the hardest piece in the world, you know.
Will you teach me?
His father looks at David for a moment, smiles, then hugs the boy tightly.
You know, one day you will play it. You will make me very proud. Very proud, won't you, David? Next time, what are we going to do?
We're going to win.
We are going to win, yes. So, good night.
Good night, Daddy.
His father kisses David on the top of his head, and the boy, in his striped pajamas, slips off the piano stool and leaves the room. His father pulls down a music score from the top of the piano. He flicks through the pages, stopping at the title page. It reads, S. Rachmaninoff, Concerto No. 3 for Piano, Opus 30. He stares at it, then closes the score. Rachmaninoff's face stares back at him from the cover. He replaces the score, carefully folds the music stand, and closes the piano. He clasps his strong, square hands together on the scratched red-brown wood of the piano lid. On a rainy day, David follows his father along a street where roses grow behind a low white wall. They open a gate between two white stone pillars and enter a wide garden with trees growing on its well-kept lawns. David, in his grey jacket and short trousers, is holding a music case over his head. They cut across the grass, past a three-tiered fountain, to a white mansion with verandas running along either side. David reaches for the big brass doorknob.
Shh, don't touch it.
They stand stiffly staring at the dark blue double doors.
Yes. Mr. Rosen, I have decided I would like you teach David. This.
David's father hands Rosen a score.
Rachmaninoff, don't be ridiculous.
But he can play it already.
He's just a boy. How can he express that sort of passion?
You are a passionate man, Mr. Rosen. You will teach him, though.
No. I will teach him what I think is best.
Rachmaninoff is best.
David nods firmly.
But you as teacher, I let you decide.
Thank you. We'll start with Mozart.
Mr. Rosen?
I can't afford to pay.
The shirt-sleeved Rosen ushers the boy inside, then shuts the door in his father's face. The man stands for a moment, turns, puts on his hat, and walks slowly down the path. Sylvia clambers out of the red Jaguar and opens the back door of the car for the adult David.
Come on, David. Sylvia's getting wet.
Oh, sorry, Sylvia. Sorry. Bye-bye, tiny boy.
See you later.
Oh, trying to catch a dog. Dog's a pussycat. Oh, oh, look out.
They scamper up a path past a sign saying Eden Lodge.
You'll be right then, David.
Oh, fine, 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 thank you. This is it. Home sweet home.
Oh, you can play.
Oh, kind of play. Kind sweet Sylvia. Chopin, Sylvia, Chopin Z, the Pole, Popolsky, like Daddy and his family, before they were concentrated.
How long have you been here, David?
Oh, golly, I don't know, a few years, I think. Eons, I suppose. How does that sound? And Schubert, nothing wrong with Schubert, of course, except syphilis. Was it syphilis? I think it was. And then he got typhoid on top of that, so that was the end of him, wasn't it? We lost him. That was a bit careless of us, wasn't it? Oh, we lost him.
So you're back?
Oh, Jim, I've been a naughty boy. Was I a naughty boy? I've been a naughty boy.
I was about to send out a search party.
Oh, a party, Jim. I won't be invited again.
Came into my restaurant and seemed a bit lost, so.
He's very good at that.
Celebrations.
Thanks for bringing him home.
We'll have a party.
Bye, David.
It's time for a wine, a very fine time. A Mardi Gras, a nice long cigar.
A stout man with mutton chop whiskers shows Sylvia out. David looks out at the rain. In a concert hall, a teenage David clasps a big silver cup.
The winner and our youngest ever state champion, David Helfgott.
David bows. On a gantry backstage, his father embraces Ben Rosen.
We won. Thanks to Mozart.
And now we can play Rachmaninoff.
And now to present David with the prize money, our very special guest from America, ladies and gentlemen, currently on tour in Australia, Mr. Isaac Stern.
They watch a bulky man in evening dress walk on stage, shake David's hand, and give him an envelope.
You have a very special talent, David.
Thank you, Mr. Stern. So do you.
How much are you prepared to give to your music, David?
How much?
David, everything!
Shh! Everything, but I do like tennis and chemistry, too.
And do you play tennis as well as you play Mozart?
I just play up against the wall at home. I bounce the ball against the wall, mainly.
How would you like to go to a special school in the States where music bounces off the walls?
America.
You know, land of the free, home of the brave, Mickey Mouse.
Ladies and gentlemen, what an honor for our young state champion. An invitation to study in America.
In the darkness, David's father stops clapping and stares down at his son. On a sunny day, David and Margaret take washing off the line, helped by their little sister.
And now, all the way from America, David Helfgott!
He's not from America.
Well, he's going to America, and when he comes back, he'll be coming from there, won't you, David?
I suppose so.
Margaret!
Through a gap in the corrugated iron fence, a teenage boy beckons to Margaret, who slips through the gap and joins him. In the kitchen, Mr. Helfgott faces Rosen.
No, I have no money to send David to America.
Well, we'll raise it.
What?
Rosen gazes at the black and white photo of David's grandfather, a severe-looking bearded man.
Bar mitzvah. David hasn't yet had his bar mitzvah.
Mr. Helfgott exchanges a glance with his wife, who's holding another young child. Then he gazes into the garden.
Religion is nonsense.
It's also a gold mine if you know where to dig.
Hands in pockets, Mr. Helfgott strolls into the garden where David is playing on a swing with his little sister.
And then one day, I'll play with an orchestra.
Wow, can I come when you do?
You can ride in my Cadillac.
Where are you going to live in America?
With a nice Jewish family, they said.
This is not a nice family.
Oh, yes, that is. Very nice.
You're very lucky to have a family, David.
Mr. Helfgott looks over a strand of barbed wire into the next garden. Margaret sees her father, hands some records back to the boy, and heads for the gap.
I've got to go.
Rosen and Mrs. Helfgott face each other across the kitchen table.
It's one of the finest music schools in the world.
It is for his father to decide.
He would be well looked after, I assure you. Mm. Rachel, please. David could be one of the truly great pianists.
He is just a boy, Mr. Rosen. He still wets his bed.
Margaret glances at them on her way through the room. Outside, Mr. Helfgott closes up the gap in the fence. On a sunny day, Mr. Helfgott pedals along a scruffy street on a tricycle contraption. Two wheels at the front support a wide box. David runs alongside, filling the box with empty bottles. Three girls stop playing hopscotch to let them pass. David's little sister hops through their chalked boxes, and one of the girls sticks out her tongue at her. In the garden, Mr. Helfgott splits logs with an axe.
You see how fit I am? How strong?
Show me the lion scratcher when you worked at the circus, Daddy.
Oh, yes.
Helfgott shows his daughter something on the inside of his forearm.
That's what happens when you get too close to the party. David, David, come. Hit me. Yeah, as hard as you can. You too. As hard as you can. You see, a man of steel. No one can hurt me, because in this world, only the fit survive. The weak get crushed like insects.
Like grasshoppers, Daddy.
Believe me, if you want to survive in America, you have to be fit and strong.
Like you, Daddy.
Yeah. Like me, yes. Yeah, that's good.
Three black framed pictures of rabbis in academic robes hang on the yellow wall of a corridor. Mr. Helfgott, wearing a skullcap, sits gazing up at them. He glances at the typist sitting at one end of the corridor. From a table beside him, he picks up a newspaper, the Maccabean. Under the headline, Young David on the Road to Fame, is a photo of himself sitting beside David at a piano.
See you next week, David. Don't forget to study. Thank you
very much. A portly man in glasses and skullcap leads David out of a room and hands him a book. Mr. Helfgott puts his arm round David's shoulders and they set off down the long corridor. The rabbi is still watching when Mr. Helfgott pulls off his skullcap. In the hall of a grand mansion, a lady in an evening dress swoops forward.
Mr. Helfgott, it is exciting, isn't it? David, the Lord Mayor is dying to meet you.
As the woman hustles David away, Rosen joins Mr. Helfgott.
Peter? Mr. Rosen.
Ladies and gentlemen, can I have your attention, please? I would like to thank our wonderful Lord Mayor for establishing this fund to send David to America. And now to play for us our very own David Helfgott.
Mr. Helfgott, in a brown jacket and tie, stands in front of a potted palm, watching grimly as men in black evening dress and women in full-length gowns, glittering with jewelry, stream past him. At home, he sits on the side of his bed, taking off his boots.
These people are a disgrace. They think they are so important. What do they know with the first and the diamonds? It makes me sick to the stomach. And Rosen, what kind of man is he? He's not married. He has no children. Don't ever talk to me about this.
If all you want for David the same as you have always wanted.
Don't ever compare me to him. What has he suffered? Not a day in his life. What does he know? Does he know about families? About how your sisters died, and my mother and father.
Having tenderly straightened a black and white picture on the wall, Mr. Helfgott bends to pick up his boots. His plump, pale-faced wife, lying in bed, watches him sitting in an armchair with a big scrapbook in his lap. He turns the pages slowly, grinning at an article from a paper with the headline, Born to the Piano. He continues to leaf through the book, smiling at exam certificates, glancing at newspaper clippings. He closes the book and sits thoughtfully, his head bowed. Then carefully rearranges a thin travelling rug to hide the frayed and torn fabric on the arm of the chair. In a book-lined room, the Australian and Russian flags flank a portrait of Lenin. A man with thinning hair leads applause for David as he stands up from a piano.
Thank you, David. Thank you, Comrade Helfgott. There's something as a credit to you. On behalf of the Soviet Friendship Society, we applaud you.
Later, the casually dressed audience chat over refreshments. The spokesman brings a smiling, white-haired woman to David's father. A girl with long blonde hair wearing a red cardigan and grey dress climbs the stairs to a balcony serving the top bookshelves and approaches David.
You play beautifully.
Thank you.
My name's Sonia.
I'm David.
I know who you are. You've got the most wonderful hands.
So do you.
So, you're going to America?
That's right, yeah.
One day you'll go to Russia too.
Why not?
They grin shyly at each other.
David.
I'm here.
There's someone important who wants to meet you.
Smiling, Sonia watches David go. She stands on tiptoe to look over the balcony and meets the cold stare of Mr. Helfgott, who takes David's arm and leads him to Catherine Pritchard.
I've never met anyone who plays the piano as beautifully as you, David.
Never met a writer before, Mrs. Pritchard.
You must be very proud of him.
As proud as a father can be.
I have a long-suffering old piano at home.
Suffering piano?
From neglect. Perhaps you'll come and play it for me one day.
Yes, anything to help.
I'd like that very much.
Me too.
Your attention, comrades. I wish to propose a toast.
That's my cue.
To our founder, very special guest this evening, Catherine Susanna Pritchard.
You will learn much from this old woman. She has been to Soviet Union, you know.
They join the main group around Mrs. Pritchard, who holds up a glass, acknowledging the applause. In morning sunshine, a postman rides a red bike along a suburban pavement. He shoves letters into a mailbox on a gatepost. David trots down the path, extracts the letters, and examines them.
America!
He races inside.
We've been informed of your exceptional talent and can only say how privileged we feel to have you come and stay with us. We're sure you'll feel very much at home here. And you'll be pleased to know we're having the Bösendorfer tuned especially. We eagerly await your imminent arrival.
Imminent, don't you? I wonder if they've got a Cadillac.
Imminent arrival. And look forward to hearing you play for us. Kindest wishes, Simon and Basha Mickelberg.
Read again!
Shush! You'll wake the baby.
You'll enjoy the company of our parakeet and our poodle called Margaret.
Hey, it is not.
It is too...
Enough! Enough! Turn it off! Where is he left? David is not going anywhere.
Mr. Helfgott snatches the letter, strides to the stove and opens the door.
Daddy?
What are you looking at, you fools? He's not going to America. I won't let anyone destroy this family!
Please, Daddy, don't.
Helfgott hurls the letter into the flames.
I know, David, what is best. Because I'm your father. I'm your father, and this is your family! David! David, come back! Come back!
Where was it?
I know what's best. Believe me. Close it off!
A hand grabs the brass bell pull beside a dark blue door. David tugs off his glasses, leans against the door, and slowly slides down it until he's crouching on the doorstep. Tears dribble down his cheeks from his squeezed shut eyes. His mouth twists in misery. Night. The house is in darkness. Only the porch light shines on the huddled figure in the doorway. A single discolored brass tap sticks out of a wall, dripping into the white bath, in which David is sitting, wet and naked, hunched forward with his arms folded over his knees, water trickling down his face from his wet hair. He looks across the room. His father comes in and takes off his dressing gown.
Time to get out, David. It's my turn for the bath. Are you feeling better now? Have you stopped shivering? You know, bath is always the best, David, always. Disgusting element. To shit in the bath. To do this to me. You disgusting animal!
Face contorted with rage, Helfgott thrashes David with his towel. David stares at his knees, shivering. At the front of a synagogue, David stands between the rabbi and his father. They all wear wide prayer shawls, white with black stripes, and their heads are covered. David uses a pointer to follow the words on the scroll of the Torah as he reads the scripture. From the gallery, his mother, sisters, and other women watch. The body of the synagogue is filled with men following the reading in their own copies of the scripture, among them Ben Rosen. Mr. Helfgott stares grimly ahead. Night. Ben Rosen leaves his car, strides up to the Helfgott's house, and swings open the fly door.
I know you can hear me.
Helfgott stands motionless in the dark hall.
Don't do this to David. You mustn't stop him going. Peter!
Rosen leans his forehead against the frosted glass of the door. Rosen starts to go, stops on the porch and returns to the door.
Whatever you do, don't you dare inflict bloody rotten man enough on him. He's not ready.
As Rosen goes, Helfgott's head drops and he leans back against the wall. In bed with the light on, David is lying on his side, eyes open, frowning. A shadow moves across his face.
To aid your father. You know, life is cruel, but music. Music, it will always be your friend. Everything else will let you down. In the end, everything, believe me, everything. Hasmanish, David. Don't hate me. Life is cruel. But you have to survive. You have to survive. Say it.
You have to survive, Daddy. You have to survive.
His father moves stiffly over to the bed and sits, looking down on the back of David's head. David rolls over and they hug.
I will always be with you, forever and ever.
Forever and ever, Daddy.
The man cradles his son, rocking slightly from side to side. Daytime, in a different bedroom. On the floor in front of an open piano, the adult David is lying on his side, his head on a cushion, his knees are drawn up, his hands clamped between them. He looks up at a black and white television on a desk. From his position, he sees the picture sideways. He puts on his glasses and reaches down a crumpled letter from beside the TV. He peers at the red crest on the letterhead, under which is printed Royal College of Music. In late afternoon sunshine, the teenage David, wearing a white wind cheater and carrying a music case, walks between the grey trunks of gum trees towards a doorway in a row of terraced houses. He sits back from a piano with candle sconces and a gold cloth on top.
Each time you play for me, it expresses so completely the inexpressible.
Is that good?
It's divine.
Inexpressibly divine.
Quite.
Mrs. Pritchard crosses the cluttered room and sits beside the piano.
Tell me a story, Catherine. What's the story today?
A new story. Drops of water.
Raindrops.
Yes, raindrops.
Outside in the golden evening, they sit under an awning slung between two gum trees, eating at a trestle table. David takes something from an inside pocket and gives it to Catherine.
Perfect. I shall treasure this till the day I die.
She holds a black and white photo of a smiling David in a jacket and badly knotted tie, wire-rimmed glasses, with a wisp of hair sticking up. The framed photo stands on her mantelpiece.
To you, all these wild weeds and windflowers of my life, I bring, my lord, and lay them at your feet. They're not frankincense or myrrh, but you are Krishna, Christ, and Dionysus in your beauty, tenderness, and strength.
David, smoking a cigarette and wearing black horn-rimmed glasses, sits behind Catherine writing as she reads. Bright stage lights are reflected in the lid of an open concert grand piano. Backstage, David, sleeves rolled up, with a cigarette in his mouth, soaks his hands in a bowl of water. Another young man nods at him before sitting at a piano. A young woman in a gold evening dress passes by, playing the violin. A second in green plays the cello. On stage, David in evening dress walks slowly around the piano, touching, almost holding it.
That was our final contestant, David Helfgott, with a very stern Rachmaninoff. Well, what a close contest we have, with the national championship almost certain to go to one of the two pianists.
Bravo, David.
I dare say it's going to be difficult for the judges to separate them. Either one a worthy winner. The judges are now conferring.
In her armchair at home, Catherine smokes and sips whiskey. In the shadows backstage, the contestants pace around David, who glances at the other pianist.
It's a tough game, isn't it, Roger? It's a blood sport.
The pianist stares with anxious eyes at the curtains which separate them from the auditorium, where three judges whisper to each other and study notes on the table in front of them. Peter Helfgott shifts uneasily in his seat, staring round the audience who chatter happily. He spots Rosen with another man, both in evening dress. Their eyes meet, and Peter looks away. A man climbs the steps onto the stage and walks up to a microphone. Peter sits forward.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm pleased to announce the winner of this year's instrumental and vocal competition. Our new national champion is...
The competitors wait tensely.
Roger Woodward.
David nods, murmurs something and shakes Woodward's hand. Peter stares miserably down. Woodward walks past David to the center of the stage, thrusting his hands high above his head. He shakes the announcer's hand and bows low. Rosen sighs grimly. He glances over at Peter, who looks at him briefly, looks away, then gets to his feet and leaves hurriedly. In the wings, David pushes up his glasses and rubs his eyes with one hand. He folds his arms tightly, stares down, his face taut and miserable. Daytime. Catherine is writing at her desk. David, in a grey woolen jerkin, carries a box of logs in through the open door and puts it down by the fireplace. As he straightens up, he looks at an old photo of a man in a wing collar with a moustache. He sits on a sofa, still staring at the photo on the mantelpiece.
What was he like, Catherine? Your father?
He was forever busy in his study. Go away, Catty, I'm writing, he'd always say. One day, when I was very young, I got so annoyed that I upset the inkpots all over his desk and scrawled on his work pages of it. When he saw it, he just stood there seething with anger. I could feel it. What are you doing? He shouted. Oh, there was this terrible silence. And I just stared at him and said, go away, Daddy, I'm writing. He ran at me and he picked me up and he cuddled me, breathless. My first literary effort, he always called it.
Catherine turns towards David, who is slowly shaking his head.
David, what is it?
David pulls a folded piece of paper from his jerkin pocket. She takes it from him, unfolds it, puts on her glasses and reads.
Royal College of Music. A scholarship. Oh, David, that's marvellous.
Daddy won't cuddle me, Catherine.
He can't stop you, David.
He's such an angry lion, Catherine.
Oh, nonsense. He's a pussycat.
Sitting on the arm of the sofa, Catherine cuddles David.
I'll miss you.
She strokes David's hair.
These were for my son, but you better have them. It gets very, very cold in London.
Catherine takes a pair of bright red gloves from a cardboard box, hands them to David and hugs him. Outside, David stands on a tree-lined track under a grey sky and slowly slides a glove onto his right hand. He holds up both gloved hands and stares at them. Nighttime, David slips stealthily through the front door into the dark hallway. He tiptoes through the living room to his bedroom door and switches on the light. Behind him, his father, sitting in an armchair, turns on a table lamp.
David? Where have you been?
I missed the train.
That Richard woman.
What is it?
The gloves.
He confronts David, who leans nervously in the bedroom doorway. David slowly takes the letter from his pocket.
And you think you can just do as you please?
David grabs the letter.
I want to go, and you can't stop me.
I'm your father, who has done everything for you. Everything!
You cruel, careless boy!
Mom!
Stupid!
Mom!
Stupid!
Mom!
Leave him! Leave him!
Let
leave
him! Him.
Oh, go, 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 go! Go! If you want to go, go!
Oh, oh, please! Oh, 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 oh. Stop it!
Peter steps back from David, who is huddled on the floor.
He's all right. Are you all right?
David cowers away from his father.
Yeah, come on, David. It's all right.
Old enough to make up my own mind.
He thinks he's going to London.
I've been accepted into the Royal College of Music.
What do you think is going to happen to you in London? Here you go. You will never come back into this house again. You will never be anybody's son. The girls will lose their brother. Is that what you want? You want to destroy your family?
I'm sorry.
Peter hugs David tight.
David, if you love me, you will stop this mess. You will not step out that door. David, here you go. You will be punished. For the rest of your life, my David, don't go.
Mrs. Helfgott sobs as David opens the front door.
David! Don't make me do it!
Peter stares at the floor. He puts out a shaky hand to lean against the doorframe for a second. He takes off his glasses and rubs his eye with the back of his hand. In the dark night, a bonfire rages, casting a pink glow on Peter's face. He is ripping pages from David's scrapbook and hurling them into the flames. Yellow tongues of fire leap and flicker as they devour the photos and cuttings. Peter's glasses reflect two fires as he watches grimly, and showers of sparks fly up into the black sky. London pigeons fly up into a cloudy grey sky from a wide four-storey stone and red brick building. Under its pediment, gold letters spell Royal College. Two men gaze out of a window at the huge, domed Albert Hall opposite.
He has the most fantastic hands.
Not connected to anything above his shoulders.
Yeah, he's a bit fragile, certainly.
Chopin Z.
I've seen enough to suggest that he could make the finals in the concerto trials.
What have you seen, Cecil?
Moments of genius.
Genius? Really?
Outside, David scampers after a shower of dropped papers.
Come on, David. Boldness of attack. Diablerie. The devil, David.
Mustn't break the piano.
Liszt broke plenty of strings.
Right.
Come on. Fill in for this useless arm of mine. The notes first. The interpretation comes on top of them.
On top, yes.
You agree, do you?
Oh, yes, I always agree, Professor.
Is that wise?
I don't know, is it?
Don't forget it's on the page.
Yes, well, the notes are on the page, but not the feeling, the emotion. That's what I feel.
You must sacrifice everything to emotion. It's all a question of balance.
Is that the question, Professor?
Precisely.
I thought so. That's what I thought.
They sit side by side, David playing the left hand, the Professor the right. A hand waves a check from the foot of a staircase.
Mr. Helfgott, your allowance check.
Thank you, Mr. Rudd.
Sorry. I'll just stand still here.
Be careful, David.
Oh, by all means, Sarah. You look lovely today, Sarah.
Thank you, David.
You too, Muriel.
He's our help girl.
Sarah!
David, you missed the bank. Pity. You'll have to wait until tomorrow. Can't bank on the bank.
We know someone who can cash it.
Do we, Robert?
What are friends for?
On a tiny stage, two girls wearing only glittery G-strings gyrate gently. One of the students thrusts a long cigar into David's mouth, while the second takes money from David's inside pocket and pays a blonde waitress for the beer she's brought them. Through the smoky gloom of the club, a man in a blonde wig with a red feather boa over his shoulders stares fixedly at David. In the grey light of dawn, a pigeon peers into David's sleeping face. A red feather boa lies around his neck. Stiffly, he sits up, puts on his glasses, to discover that he's been sleeping in Trafalgar Square between the massive paws of one of the bronze lions. He jumps down and sets off across the wet, empty square. At her desk, Catherine is listening to a tape recorder.
Gotta concentrate, Catherine. Gotta practice, because there's three important things Professor Park says, and that's work. So that's what I have to do, isn't it? If I'm going to make the finals for the concerto medal, because the winner of which gets to play at the Royal Albert Hall, which is right outside the window. So, I bought a piano, Catherine, a beautiful piano. It's a suffering piano like yours.
In his attic bedsit, David speaks into a microphone.
I wrote to Daddy, so that's a positive. It's a positive, isn't it? Because, well, it seems to be, because he didn't write back, but...
As the tape runs out, David adds a letter stamped return to sender to a pile of similar ones on his untidy windowsill. He slips a pill into his mouth and stares skinny and hunched out of the dirty window. David rushes to the college notice board.
No, I don't want to... Do we
managed to get in the finals, dear David.
No conductors, neither.
It's true. And what are we going to do? We're going to win, actually, Robert. We're going to win.
Parks is reclining on a chaise longue.
Rachmaninoff, are you sure?
Kind of. I'm never really sure about anything, Mr. Parks.
Rack 3. It's monumental.
It's a mountain. It's the hardest piece you could ever play.
Well, no one's ever been mad enough to attempt the Rack 3.
Am I mad enough, Professor? Am I?
David sits at a grand piano.
Think of it as two separate melodies, jousting for supremacy. The hands, giants, 10 fingers each. Performing's a risk, you know. No safety net. Make no mistake, David. It's dangerous. People get hurt. You have to learn to be able to play it blindfolded. The page, for God's sake, the notes.
Sorry, I was forgetting them, Professor.
Would it be asking too much to learn them first?
And then forget them.
Precisely. Just give me the fingering.
In his bedsit, David watches his fingers drum the notes on the piano lid while toast burns against the safety bars of his electric heater. He snips off the finger ends of his red gloves, and his fingertips, poking from the gloves, fly over the keyboard. A brown scarf tied tightly round his eyes blindfolds him. Sitting in his armchair, forking sardines from a tin, David gazes at a photo of himself with his father. He strokes a grey cat while it helps itself to sardines. In grey light, he rubs his gloved hands together before practicing. Dashing towards the professor's office, he drops a sheet of music.
David, come on, my boy. We're going to rest muscles and fingers today. Try to exercise the imagination. First movement, cadenza. Let's pick it up from pom 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 pom. Your hands must form the unbreakable habit of playing the notes so that you can forget all about them. And let it come from here. The heart. That's where it comes from.
The hammers of the professor's grand piano leap and fall onto the strings. David frowns fiercely over the keyboard.
Those big fat chords. You have to tame the piano, David, or it'll get away from you. It's a monster. Tame it, or it'll swallow you whole. Coming along nicely, David.
They both peer at a broken string curling upwards from the piano frame. Evening. Light glows from a few of the college windows. In each lighted room, a student practices. Through a window on the first floor, David can be seen at the professor's piano. David, in his blue roll-neck sweater, slides a parcel from a pigeonhole and shakes it curiously as his landlady comes downstairs.
Morning, Mrs. Perkins.
Mrs. Perkins, in headscarf and overcoat, carrying a brown shopping bag, hesitates for a moment, shakes her head, and continues through the hall. David starts to climb the stairs. As he does, his bare bottom and legs reveal the cause of Mrs. Perkins' unhappiness. In his room, David sits cross-legged at the foot of his unmade bed and rips open the parcel. He takes out a printed card.
Catherine.
The card reads, "From the trustees and estate of Catherine Susanna Pritchard. Catherine Susanna Pritchard requested that all personal belongings and remembrances be returned after her death." From under a stack of opened envelopes, David picks out a spool of recording tape and gazes at it. He pulls out the photo of himself and stares at it, brows furrowed. A younger David with much shorter hair smiles back at him through the cracked glass. The professor leads David into a room crammed with plaster heads sitting on plinths, boxes and cabinets, and portraits in heavy gold frames leaning against everything.
I call this my little mausoleum, David.
The professor uncovers a plaster head.
Ah, Liszt. Warts and all. They made this after he was dead.
Poor friends, dead as a post, eh?
You can still get these on the left bank, you know. Quite cheap.
Hesitantly, David runs two fingertips across the plaster forehead.
I've got Rachmaninoff in here somewhere.
The old man peers at a glass-fronted cabinet.
Ah.
He pulls a cast of a hand from a cardboard box.
Magnificent fingers. So virile.
David takes the hand and inspects it curiously.
You know, I played the Rack 3 for him once.
Really?
Yes. He said he could hear himself in my playing. He said it seemed as if I touched his soul. It wasn't so bad, was it?
Not too bad at all, Professor.
Now it's your turn, David. Remember, once you've done it, nobody can ever take it away from you. And you must play as if there was no tomorrow.
David nods, purses his lips tightly, and stares at the hand. On a concert hall platform, the members of the orchestra turn to applaud the soloist. The conductor claps too, from his podium close to the piano. David, in evening dress, walks to the front of the stage, acknowledging the applause. A colleague takes a seat behind Professor Parks.
Come on, David, don't get me down.
David pulls a cigar stub from his pocket and pretends to put it in his mouth.
How many moments of genius today, Cecil?
The professor's colleague, Viney, sits back with a grim smile. On stage, David sits at the piano, the lights in the hall dim, and a spotlight focuses on him. His heavy horn-rimmed glasses lie on top of the piano, and he looks past them to nod gravely at the conductor who raises his baton. The controls of a tape recorder. As he leans over the keys, his eyelids flicker and close. Peter Helfgott stands motionless, head bowed, unblinking in front of a mantelpiece covered with all David's cups and ribbons, listening to a tape recorder. His eyes shut, his face enraptured. fingers continue to strike the keys, but his eyes are shut. His head droops and sways. Drops of sweat fall from his face and run down his hair, which hangs in damp rat's tails. David's eyes open for a moment, stare blankly at the keyboard, and close again. The audience rises to its feet. Professor Park stands slowly, thrilled and delighted. Behind him, Viney stands too. David sways slightly, mouth open, eyes blinking vaguely. Peter Helfgott holds the box of recording tape, draped with David's gold medal on a purple ribbon. A tear trickles from his tightly shut eyes. Shakily, David stands. He reaches for his glasses, can't grasp them, grabs for the piano and falls. He lies still on the floor, on his left side. One eye is wide open, unblinking. His face is wet and shiny. His glasses are lying nearby, upside down, on a floor which seems vertical to him. His glasses are dropped into a kidney dish. A hand turns a knob labelled volts on a control panel. A red light glows. The hand dials 3 on a telephone dial. A cable runs to electrodes clamped to David's temples. His eyes are closed. A black breathing tube stuck between his teeth. His face contorts as if in pain. His long, bony hand, sticking out from a white surgical gown, trembles wildly, then falls still. On a table in a dark room stands a telephone. Beside it are a postcard and some letters tucked beneath a small brass box. A hand lifts the receiver.
Hello? Who is this? Hello?
Daddy?
David is standing in the phone box.
Daddy, I'm home.
Peter puts back the receiver and stands staring down at it. David slowly hangs up. He stares down miserably, his short, untidy hair making him look young and vulnerable. Peter, in his check dressing gown, his pajama jacket buttoned to the throat, stares out of a window, then abruptly tugs down a black blind. On a sunny day, wipers clear a sudden gush of water from a car windscreen. The car, in fact a taxi, passes through another jet from a hose pipe before drawing up in front of a large grey stone mock Gothic house. A young woman gets out. The young woman chats with a nurse as they walk briskly through a quadrangle. Outside, they cross a tarmac path onto an expanse of grass. Beneath the wide-spreading branches of a tree, a man is sitting hunched on a bench with his back to them. They approach him gently.
Someone here to see you, David.
It's me, David. Susie.
Susie squats down in front of David, who slowly puts on his glasses.
Susie. Susie, do we know Susie?
Your sister, David.
Oh, Sister Susie, Sister Susan. Thank you, Sister, Sister Nurse, Sister Susie.
David, older now, draws hard on a thin hand-rolled cigarette. Susie sits close beside him on the bench.
David, I won't be able to come and visit so often.
Not so often, sweet Susie, not so often.
I'm going to live in Melbourne.
Oh, that's a trick, don't tell Daddy. The milk mustn't cry over spilt milk. Oh, well, what can you do, Margaret, what can you do?
Margaret's in Israel, remember?
I remember Margaret, she called me Dopey. Or was it a pig? It was the poodle. It was all very complicated, wasn't it? Complicato in Israel. It was a battleground, a war zone. It was such a bore. It was a war. It just destroys everything, really, doesn't it?
David constantly rocks to and fro as he speaks and puffs hard on his cigarette. Susie leans back on the bench unhappily. and they sit side by side in silence. David stands motionless, gazing through a window. Outside, a breeze twitches the last few leaves on the tree. The hinge on one arm of his glasses is bound with sellotape. Sunlight streams through the Gothic windows, splashing three long, pointed stripes on the gleaming floor. Other people are sitting on the shady side of the room. In a white-painted room, a woman hurls something onto the floor. David is sitting on a chair in the middle of the room, smoking. His lips are moving, and on the arm of his chair, the fingers of his right hand ripple through some remembered music. David's lips are still moving as he focuses on the black and white keys of a piano. He's looking through a glass door into a room where a drum kit stands beside an open, upright piano. Stuck to the olive green wall behind it is a poster of an 18th century composer.
David?
That's right, nurse, that's right.
I knew I'd find you here.
I've been a naughty boy again, haven't I? I misbehaved, haven't I, nurse? I think I have.
That's come true, on, David.
I might get into trouble. I might get punished for the rest of my life because I'm flawed. I'm fatally flawed. That's right.
Isn't silly it? Sausage.
It's forbidden fruit. The doctor says it's forbidden fruit.
They walk slowly up the corridor, the nurse's arm around David's waist. David hops and skips through an imaginary game of hopscotch. In a pink-painted washroom, David lies almost completely submerged in a full white bathtub.
The thing is, he didn't approve, did he? He was very disapproving. Oh, he's very excited disapproving. He did like that old scuttle away, that old over there.
David, in a grey sleeveless pullover and a checked shirt, gazes through the glass door of the music room, then goes in. He shuffles past a plump woman in a red sweatshirt, dancing gently like an uncoordinated child. Other patients sit and stand around. One plays with some tubular bells. David stops beside the pianist, a woman with thick, short, grey hair, and turns over the music for her.
Oh, so you can read music?
Oh, kind of. Perhaps I'm just turning over a new leaf. But that's all right, isn't it?
My name's Beryl Alcott. What's yours?
Alcott. Oh, that sounds a lot like my name. Healthcott, that's my name, Beryl.
Healthcott?
That's right. Ridiculous. It means with the help of God. It's ridiculous.
What's your first name, Mr. Healthcott?
Oh, your first things first, Beryl. David, that's right.
You're David Healthcott.
That's right, Beryl, that's right.
But I used to watch you win all those competitions.
Win some, lose some, you can't lose them all. It's not your fault.
I was quite a fan.
David's long, narrow fingers stretch over the keyboard and softly stroke the keys.
Do you still play?
Oh, I mustn't. The doctor said I mustn't. It'll all end in tears if I misbehave.
You mustn't.
I mustn't harangue the doctor. I mustn't, that's right. That's right. Is that right? I think it's right, because it might damage me. The doctor said it might damage me because it did long time ago, once before. Long time ago. Yeah, that's the story, so what can you do? So you see, you play, Beryl. Come on, you play. Boldness of attack. Oh, that's good, Beryl. That's good. Oh, very good left hand. The point is, you see, you've got to share and care and care and share and just behave. That's right, isn't it, Beryl? That's right, yes. It's going to be a stylish marriage. It's a stylish marriage, Beryl. Oh, that's very good, Beryl. Very good. Oh, press those pedals. Oh, we're on the bicycle, Beryl. Pedal, Beryl.
What goes on in his head?
God only knows.
He's pretty confusing at the best of times.
How serious is
it? Complex disorder. He kind of lives in his own little world.
Lost soul.
He's a sweetie. He could leave tomorrow if he had somewhere to go.
Beryl, walking through the quadrangle with a nurse, stops suddenly. David stands outside the front door of the home carrying two bags.
Come along, David.
Beryl.
He climbs into Beryl's pale blue Morris Minor.
David, you know I can't abide smoke.
Oh, sorry, Beryl, sorry.
What are you doing?
I'll walk.
But you don't know the way.
I'll follow you. How does that sound?
Oh, it's all right. Get in, David. God bless you, David.
Help God. How's this, Beryl? Is this all right?
David sticks his head and shoulders out of the window as they whiz by a sign for Glendale Psychiatric Hospital. In a small church, a choir practices, ladies arrange flowers, the vicar prepares the altar, and David turns a page of music for Beryl, who's playing the organ. At night, David sits up suddenly in bed.
Is that you, nurse?
All right, David. I'm here.
Here, never fear. Oh, where's the nurse? Where's the sister, Beryl?
This is where you live now, David.
Oh, that's fine. I'm fine. I know Daisy Beryl.
This is where David Helfgott really gets back on the rails.
Oh, that's the story.
David snuggles up to Beryl and she firmly removes his hand from her breast. Beryl enters her kitchen, where biscuits, crumbs and tea bags cover the floor. She rushes through the equally messy lounge and into the bathroom. David sits up in a foam-filled bath, slopping water onto the floor. Beryl, looking shocked and angry, retreats. In church, the choir, in white surplices, hold their heads high as they sing. Beryl, in a pale green suit, is playing the organ, with David sitting beside her. He leans forward to turn a page for her, and she smiles at him. He reaches forward again and grabs at her breast. She glares at him and glances into a mirror beside the organ. It reflects the disapproving face of the priest at the altar. David is sitting miserably in the car.
Botanical Gardens just down the road. Nice walk. You'll be able to come and go as you please. Mr. Minogue's a lovely man, a real Christian gentleman. I know you're going to like him, David. And guess what? You'll even have your own piano.
David, a cigarette between his lips, is sitting at a battered old upright piano with the front panel missing. One day in a white vest, another day a green shirt, another a blue patterned shirt, with cigarette ends piling up on the music stand and music around his feet, he hunches over the keyboard. From the pile of scores on top of the piano, a small tabby cat watches him. He's sitting despondently. Sellotape holds one lens of his glasses together. Back at the piano, he wears a red-brown check shirt. At the piano, he's fast asleep.
Good morning, David. Wakey-wakey, rise and shine. It's breakfast time. I think it's about time we gave that piano another rest, eh, David? Sign your cheque. Look at you. You should get out and exercise.
Exercise, yes, that's right.
Get some fresh air into those lungs of yours, David.
Because the weak get crushed like insects, don't they? Like grasshoppers.
The stout man locks the piano and leaves with David's cheque. In the botanical gardens, three joggers trot past enormous trees with huge rubber plants growing beneath them. David sits smoking on a bench, wearing his brown raincoat. Two more joggers approach him, a man and a woman with long blonde hair which swings as she runs. David watches the couple jog through a long, airy tunnel with vines growing over it and follows them, his raincoat flapping around his legs, his arms waving wildly at his sides. He gallops on through the parkland, past great trees, occasionally throwing out his arms as if in triumph. City street. David, with a sodden cigarette clenched between his teeth, runs on through the streaming rain. His hair is plastered to his head, and his wet face gleams grey-blue in the artificial light from shops and street lamps. He stops and looks around him. Turning towards the sound of a piano, he sees a wine bar called Moby's. He rushes to the window and peers in. The pianist, a waiter and waitress all wander over to the bar. Blue neon light flickers on a fish tank in the window. The pianist, perched on a stool at the bar, looks over and waves dismissively. David rushes from the window to the door, and the waiter heads towards it. In his room, David is lying on his side on the floor, so the picture on the TV looks sideways to him. He's reading a crumpled piece of paper. He twiddles an opened-out paperclip in the lock of the piano without success and slaps the piano lid in frustration. He stares at the piano for a moment, then stands up, still in his raincoat, takes a stack of music from the top of the piano and leaves. In Moby's, diners look up in surprise as David shambles nervously to the open piano. The pianist, in a multicoloured shirt, is sitting at the bar.
Sylvia, your stray dog's back.
You want me to get rid of him for you?
No, I'll have him.
David drops his music on the floor.
Hey, baby, what about a tune?
Tune, baby, sure, no worries, no worries.
Leaving the music on the floor, David pulls the stool up to the piano.
Bravo, bravo, encore. Oh, sock it to us, Liberace.
That's enough.
Delightedly. The eyes of the other pianist flicker around the room before he turns away, his glass to his lips.
Two more, ready, mate?
The waiter wriggles through customers crowded together on the stairs down to the bar, which is also crammed with people. In the middle of the wine bar, David stands and acknowledges the applause. He's wearing a light grey velvet jacket, white shirt, and a maroon velvet bow tie. Seen from outside, he's standing by the piano lighting a new cigarette from a stub. Inside, three girls crowd around him at the piano, and another hands him a glass of champagne.
Hey, give us Beethoven's Fifth.
Sure, baby, no worries. Symphony or concerto.
Under a newspaper headline reading, "Remember Who," is a photo of David and the girls. Peter Helfgott gazes at the picture, then lowers the paper slowly. Below the first picture is the photo of the young David, entitled "David Shines." Peter's face is set, unmoving, as he stares at the pictures. From the dark street outside Moby's, the waiters can be seen clearing empty tables. David, in white shirt and bow tie, wends his way between them and climbs the stairs. In his bedsit above the bar, he opens a small fridge.
I played quite well tonight, didn't I? I played quite well. So I deserve a bit of a snack. You say.
He turns and sees his father in the doorway.
Hello, David.
Hello, Daddy. Hello.
He bends to pick up the dropped can.
Are you feeling well?
Well. The thing is, the lid, I can't open them. There's something wrong with them.
What could be wrong, David?
Oh, it's a mystery. It's a mystery.
Close it. Come to me. I'll show you.
Peter closes the fridge door, takes the can from David, and searches for an opener. David watches nervously as his father masters the can opener.
You see? How easy it is.
Couldn't be easier. That's right, couldn't be easier.
David,
From his pocket, Peter takes the purple ribbon holding the medal and places it carefully around his son's neck. He straightens David's collar and gently lifts his chin.
Look at me. You are a lucky boy, David.
That's true, that's true. It seems to be true. People say that they think that I'm...
David, get to the point.
Yeah, I'm a very lucky boy.
Peter reaches out to put his hands on David's shoulders. He hugs his son tightly, eyes squeezed shut.
No one will love you like me. No one like me.
David stares blankly over his father's shoulder. Peter steps back. One lens of his glasses is held together with sellotape.
You see? Do you realize what for an opportunity you have here?
Opportunity for a lifetime, that's right, Daddy.
David, when I was a boy, I bought a violin, beautiful violin. I saved for this violin. You know what happened to it? You know what happened to it?
No, what happened to it, Daddy? I have no idea what happened. I've got no idea.
David moves away and stands by the window with his back to his father. Peter blinks, his head droops, and he slowly turns away.
The thing is, you've got to be fit to survive, haven't you, to stay alive? That's right, isn't it?
David turns around, but the room is empty. He sits on a chair, holds up his gold medal, and scrutinizes it. The words, "Awarded to David Helfgott," are inscribed on it. Outside, Peter trudges stiffly along the wet street.
Good night, Daddy.
David watches from his window, light from the bar sign below shining blue on his face. Sylvia hauls a suitcase from a car boot.
Where are the kids? Around somewhere, amusing themselves.
She leads a tall blonde woman to the front door of her house.
I must warn you, I've got someone staying on weekends.
Not now the Scorpio, is it?
Oh, very funny, Gills. He's a child prodigy.
Inside, she steps over cushions strewn on the floor and dumps the heavy suitcase in a bedroom. She disappears into a living room, also strewn with papers and a cushion, almost trips over something else on the floor, and returns to the bedroom door.
Is that the water running?
Sylvia's smile disappears.
David!
She hurtles into a bathroom, turns off basin taps.
David!
She reaches in and turns off the shower. Outside, David bounces high in the air on a trampoline, listening ecstatically to a Walkman. He's wearing nothing but an unbuttoned raincoat, shoes, and a stripe of white sun cream across his face. Sylvia's son and daughter rush to meet her.
Where does it go?
David, I want you to meet someone.
There's no more hot water, Sylvia. It's all gone, all gone, all gone. Where does it go? Who can say? I don't know. Where does hot water go?
Killing,
I don't know, Doctor.
Killing's a very dear friend of mine.
Oh, friendly doctor. I've got better already.
Pleased to meet you. No, she's not a doctor.
Oh, not a doctor, sweet Sylvia.
No, she's
not
an astrologer.
Oh, a specialist, a heart
she's
surgeon.
She's from Sydney.
Oh, an open heart surgeon.
Ridiculous.
Oh, I'm ridiculous, aren't I? Gillian, that's it.
If you're lucky, Gillian might do a chart for you.
Oh, would she, Sylvia?
You
would
will,
she?
Won't
would
you, Gillian?
Do a chart for me?
Will, yes.
What sort of chart, Sylvia?
An
what sort
astrological
of chart? Oh, the stars. Yes. I love the stars. Astronomical,
and
very
the
astronomical. Oh, the planets. Mustn't forget the planets, of course. Mercury and Neptune and so forth. Oh, the music of the spheres. If music be the food of love. Oh, very gastronomical, isn't it, Gillian? Oh, the food of love. It is, Gillian. Oh.
What's he like when he gets to know you better?
Oh.
In Moby's, David is playing. Gillian, sitting at the bar in a long gold dress, watches David. She glances round, sees the rapt expressions of other customers, looks back at David and smiles. Sylvia leans on the bar opposite Gillian.
So what does he do?
Ah, he's an investment advisor. That's how I met him.
So far, so good. How serious is it? Oh, come on, Gills, on a scale of 1 to 10.
Gillian displays an engagement ring.
That was a 10. When's a happy day?
You know me. I hate to rush into things.
Gillian watches David going from table to table kissing girls. He bends low and kisses Gillian's hand. Gillian turns to watch David mount the stairs, taking off his jacket and dropping it as he goes. Halfway up the stairs, Gillian stoops to pick up the grey velvet jacket and a bow tie and continues up to David's room. He's kneeling on the floor in front of dozens of sheets of newspaper.
Mind if I come in?
Oh, hello, Doctor. Entree.
Got these. Oh, sorry.
It's not your fault, It's amazing. It just seems to be getting bigger. It's amazing who you find, isn't it, when you're not even looking. There he is.
Who?
Roger.
Ah, Roger.
Roger. Yeah, he's a winner. He's a winner.
You've got one going already.
He's a big hit. He's a big hit. One's more than enough.
Yeah. I really loved your playing.
Did you? Mm. It was all right.
Oh, do you write music as well?
Oh, no, 1, 2, 3, who? That's the Rec 3.
It started out being a letter.
A letter, Gillian? Yes, I think it was, I think so. It seems to be true.
Dear Professor Cecil, Royal College.
Of Music, Royal College of Music. It's a mystery.
What is?
Well, he only had one arm, you see. It was a stroke. Stroke about, like, yeah, poor pussycat. His paw was damaged beyond repair. He wasn't able to do a thing with it. He was sad pussycat. He was damaged. It was just bad luck, really, wasn't it? I'm not damaging you, am I?
Oh, not at all.
David leans his forehead on her shoulder.
What's the matter, David?
Oh, the matter. Well, it started out being... It's a blank. It was all such a long, 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 long time ago, Gillian. That's the story. What can you do? Inexpressible. Inexplicably inexpressible. To express the inexplicable.
Well, why don't you tell me what you want to say?
Oh, why not? What don't I want to say? Well, that's a hard one.
No, it's not hard at all. Dear.
That's it. Dear.
Dear Cecil. Cecil.
Cecil was Parks. Mr. Parks.
Dear Mr. Parks.
He touched the soul of Sergei Vasilievich himself with the Rack 3 and Dear Minus. That wasn't too bad, was it? It's a hard piece. Peace for elephants. Elephantine.
Dear Mr.
Parks. Such a long time ago.
It has been such a long time. And I hope,
Gillian, how does that sound? Is that right?
Sounds pretty good to me.
And I hope you remember me and the Rack 3. I'm feeling much better again now. I'm feeling much better again, aren't I? And I've started playing again.
Woodward finishes his concert and punches the air. Sitting beside Gillian, David applauds passionately. Piles of dark green seaweed dot a sandy beach. Big grey rollers sweep in under a pier and break in sheets of creamy foam. David is running thigh deep into the sea. On the sand, Gillian, wrapped in overcoat and scarf, sits reading a yellow paperback. She smiles as David plunges into a breaker. On Sylvia's veranda, David clings to Gillian, his face buried in her shoulder.
Smile, David!
Hello, Sylvia!
And the camera, here! Here!
Hooray!
Okay, time to go.
Well, what can you do?
David, look on the bright side.
On the bright side.
You'll see Gillian again one day.
Yes, life goes on.
It does. Is that what it does?
Yes, of course it does.
David, she has to go.
Oh, yeah, little Wrigley's to look after.
Well, hardly. No, my kids are all grown up. It's just little old me.
It's just me too. I never grew up, I grew down. Ah, I'm a bit of a handful, Gillian, aren't I? Will you marry me?
Wouldn't be very practical, David.
Not practical? No, of course not. Neither am I, Gillian. Neither am I. I'm not very practical at all.
You missed the plane!
That's sweet of you, David. I don't know what to say.
The stars, Gillian, darling. Ask the stars.
He hugs her tightly to him, his eyes closed. Her eyes are open, wondering. Through the rear window of the car, Gillian watches David in his white toweling gown and blue trunks. He's blowing kisses and waving. She waves back and blows a kiss. He bounces up and down, flapping his arms. At home, Gillian, wearing a petrol blue crochet dressing gown over white pajamas, gazes through a huge picture window across scrubby dunes to the distant sea. She stands motionless, deep in thought. Under new chart data entry on her computer screen, Gillian types David Helfgott. Pinned to a board by her desk is the photo of David with his arms around her. Nighttime. Gillian, in the same outfit, is standing at the window drinking coffee, gazing into the darkness. Her computer screen fills with astrological data. As she scans the screen, Gillian toys with the ring from her engagement finger. She looks down at the ring, holding it between finger and thumb, then gently puts it down on the star charts beside the computer.
You'd better let her breathe, David.
Hooray!
In Sylvia's garden, David, in a white suit, is kissing Gillian, who's also in white, with small white flowers twined in her blonde hair. The crowd includes David's mother and Susie and Sylvia's son, who throws petals over them. Inside, Gillian clinks champagne glasses with a woman in a grey dress and smiles lovingly at David as he plays for the singers round the piano.
Sorry, David.
Oh, so far from it.
You made a noise.
At night, David and Gillian are making love, both naked under a light cotton throw. Clinging to each other, they roll over, Gillian finishing on top of David. Sheets of music float on the surface of a swimming pool, which reflects white clouds in a blue sky. Gillian rushes to the poolside.
Oh, no, poor Ravel.
Oh, poor Maurice, he's all unraveled, all unravelled.
It's nearly time to get ready.
Can I swim some more, darling?
Oh, all right, 10 minutes. Do some Liszt. Oh, not a concerto. Swim La Campanella. Oh, that should do it.
Gillian starts to fish out music with a long-handled pole.
Oh, I've gone wrong, darling.
Keep trying, darling.
I'm trying. I'm very trying.
Page 37 is missing.
Oh, it's a coda. It's the end. It's the beginning of the end. Oh,
Sylvia drops the hairdryer she's been drying music with, and Gillian extracts the missing sheet from the pool filter system.
Gotcha.
David puts on his glasses and smiles. He's wearing odd shoes.
The first concert in years, and you wear odd shoes.
Oh, the sausage.
You certainly are. That's it. Moving up straight. Move in the car. Relax.
Oh, relax. Miss Lund, relax. Miss Lund, relax.
Gillian holds David's hands and they gaze at each other. David's glasses sit upside down on top of a grand piano. Smiling and blinking, David puts them on, then stands and walks to the front of a concert platform with the pipes of a huge organ soaring up behind him. He clasps his hands together and points at Gillian, who's clapping furiously with Sylvia beside her. In the row behind, Mrs. Helfgott smiles softly at her son and claps gently. Next to her, Susie leans forward on the verge of tears. David holds out his clasped hands and nods his thanks. Further back, Ben Rosen's shoulders heave with a sob and he applauds too. David blows kisses at Gillian, who rushes to the edge of the stage. David kneels and they hug each other.
Hi, darling.
They want an encore.
Do they, darling? They want some more.
What are you going to do?
I'm going to win.
Not now, darling.
I'll do some more. I'll do some more.
As David moves to the piano, the entire audience stands. David turns back to them, smiling, murmuring his thanks. Mrs. Helfgott, still plump, still wearing no makeup, stays in her seat until Susie helps her up. David covers his face with his hands. Rosen is standing, calling encouragement. David's hands come away from his face, which is wet with tears. He looks out at the audience. Slowly, his eyes and mouth crumple, and he begins to sob. He puts his clenched fists to his mouth and cries uncontrollably. Daytime. In a cemetery, a square headstone set on a bed of white gravel reads, "In loving memory of Elias Peter Helfgott." David looks down at it.
What do you feel?
The thing is, I feel nothing.
Nothing at all?
I'm shocked, stunned and completely amazed. How's that sound? Perhaps it's all my fault. Perhaps it's me. Perhaps I don't know.
You can't go on blaming yourself for everything that's happened.
Well, you can't go on blaming yourself. That's true, Gillian. And you can't go on blaming Daddy because he's not here anymore.
But you are.
I am here. That's true. And life goes on, doesn't it, Gillian? Is that right?
Yes.
It does. Forever and ever.
No, not forever.
No, never forever. Not quite. But I mean, the point is, life's not all lamb loin chops, is it? But I mean, it goes on, and you just have to keep on going too, don't you? You can't give up, can you?
Certainly
you can't
give not. Up. Every certainly time not. That blooming Saturn comes along and gives us a bit of a jolt.
Oh, this is. Stars, Gillian.
Everything has its season.
Oh, it's a mystery.
There's always a reason.
Oh, we just need to seize the reason for the season.
David puts his arm around Gillian's shoulders and they stroll away across the green grass of the cemetery.
Thanks to David and Gillian Helfgott for their assistance and cooperation in the making of this film. Audio description narrated by Nicolette McKenzie, written by Peter Wickham, engineer Peter Collins. Cast: David as an adult, Jeffrey Rush; Tony, Justin Brain; Sylvia, Sonia Todd; Sam, Chris Haywood; David as a child, Alex Rafalovich; iStedford presenter, Gordon Poole; Peter Armin Mullerstahl; Ben Rosen, Nicholas Bell; Susie as a child, Danielle Cox; Margaret, Rebecca Gooden; Rachel, Marta Kaczmarek; Jim Minogue, John Cousins; David as an adolescent, Noah Taylor; state champion announcer, Paul Linkson; Isaac Stern, Randall Berger; boy next door, Ian Wellborn; Louise as a baby, Kelly Bottrell; Rabbi, Beverly Vaughan; synagogue secretary, Phyllis Burford; society hostess, Daphne Gray; Soviet society secretary, Edwin Hodgman; Catherine Susanna Pritchard, Googie Withers; Sonia Maria Defnero; postman, Reese Porter; Roger Woodward, younger, Stephen Sheehan; announcer, Brenton Whittle; Susie as a teenager, Mariana Doherty; Louise as a child, Camilla James; Cecil Parks, John Gielgud; Viney, David King; registrar, Danny Davis; Sarah, Helen Dowell; Muriel, Louise Dawling; student, Sean Carlson; Ashley, Richard Hansel; Robert Hands; Ray, Mark Warren; RCOM conductor, Neil Thompson; Susie as an adult, Joey Kennedy; nurse, Ellen Cressy; Beryl Alcott, Beverly Dunn; bar customer, Andy Seymour; Gillian, Lynn Redgrave; Jessica, Ella Scott Lynch; Rowan, Jethro Hasten Hicks; Roger Woodward, older, John Martin; celebrant, Bill Boyley; opera singers, Teresa LaRocca, Lindsay Day, Grant Doyle; musicians, Leah Jennings, Cathy Monaghan, Mark Lawrence, Gordon Coombs, Margaret Stone, Tom Carrig, Helen Ayres; vocalists, Susie Jarrett, Samantha MacDonald; hand double for Noah Taylor, Martin Cousin; hand double for Alex Rafalovich, Simon Tedeschi; hand double for Jeffrey Rush, himself. The Royal College of Music Orchestra. Casting by Liz Mulliner Casting, Australia; Sharon Howard Field, USA; Karen Lindsay Stewart, UK. Creative consultant, Kerry Hasten. Story by Scott Hicks. Production designer, Vicky Nehus. Director of photography, Jeffrey Simpson, ACS. Edited by Pip Carmel. Music by David Hirschfelder. Screenplay by Jan Sardi. Crew: first assistant director, Carolyn Cunningham; second assistant directors, Henry Osborne, Guy Campbell; production manager, Elizabeth Symes; production coordinator, Serena Gattuso; producer's assistant, Christina Norman; continuity, Joe Weeks; location manager, Maurice Burns; unit manager, Andrew Marshall; camera operator, Jeffrey Simpson, ACS; focus puller, Sally Eccleston; clapper loader, Jasmine Carrocan; video split operator, Rene Hanna; second unit cameraman, David Foreman, ACS; second unit gaffer, Graham Shelton; sound recordist, Toivo Lemba; boom operator Scott Piper, gaffer Trevor Town, best boy Werner Gerlach, key grip John Goldney, art director Tony Cronin, props by a set dresser Andrew Short, props by a set dresser Alicia Walsh, art department coordinator Louise Cameron, draftsman Adam McCulloch, greensman Brock Sykes, art department attachment Jackie Canty, construction manager Arthur Vett, carpenter Kevin Jarrett, scenic artist John Haratsis, painters Ben Johnson, John Santucci, action vehicle coordinator John Blakey, costume designer Louise Wakefield, costume supervisor Jenny Miles, cutter Sue Nicola, makeup artist Leslie Vanderwalt, hairdresser Paul Williams, stills photographer Lisa Tomasetti, story research and development John McGregor, extras casting Jan Killen, stunts coordinator Richard Bowe, special effects coordinator Ray Fowler, safety report Bernadette Van Guyen, unit nurse Jenny Bichard, publicist Australia Tracy Mayer, publicist international Fiona Searson, DDA, assistant film editor Mark Ellis, post-production supervisor Sylvia Walker-Wilson, sound effects editor Gareth Van der Hope, dialogue editor Livia Ruzic, assistant sound editor Martin Bailey, Foley, Gerard Long, Steve Burgess, re-recording mixer Roger Savage, sound firm liaison Helen Field, psychiatric advisor Steve Crook, Yiddish advisor Sal Alba, bar mitzvah advisor Rabbi Figdor, assistant musical director Ricky Edwards, music production manager Peter Hoyland, music notation editor Sam Schwartz, music mixing engineer Michael Letho, additional music engineers Robin Gray, Adam Rhodes, David Williams, assistant music editor Michael Costa, music production assistants Sandy Edwards, Stella O'Malley, source music clearances Kim Green, Christine Woodruff, harpsichord technician Vladimir Chishkovsky, disclavier technician Brent Otley, studio technician Ross Clunes, orchestral leader Robert John, camera equipment Camera Equip Australian Propriety Limited, laboratory Cinevex Film Laboratories, optical effects Paul Cross, negative matching Rowan Wilson, laboratory liaison Ian Anderson, colour grading Arthur Cambridge ATLAB, videotape house AAV Australia Video Services, post-production sound Sound Firm, astrological software Esoteric Technologies Propriety Limited, music recording Adelphia Studio, Alan Eaton Studio, musical instruments Yamaha Music, Ebony and Ivory, Adelaide, Brashes, Adelaide, Manny's Music, titles Optical and Graphic, UK crew, production advisor Paul Cerrone, production coordinator Hilary Benson, continuity Susanna Linton, location manager Charles Hubbard, second assistant director Stephen Wolfenden, stills photographer Mark Tilley, art director David McHenry, props by a set dresser Judy Farr, assistant art director Joanna Graysmark, prop master Paul Purdy, clapper loader Lorraine Luke, camera trainee Alex Mumford, steadicam operator Jan Pester, focus puller steadicam Sam Garwood, grip Barry Reed, gaffer John Donahue, best boy Warren Ewan, electrician Peter Arnold, generator operator Tony Burns, sound recordist Jim Greenhorn, boom operator Joanne Stevens-Smith, wardrobe supervisor Ross Ward, makeup artist Pamela Haddock, extras casting Robert Smith Agency, additional casting Ray Knight Casting, costume hire Morris Angel & Son Limited, camera hire Ari Media Film SVC Limited, laboratory Metrocolor Film Labs. The producers wish to thank Alice Carrard, the Helfgott family, Wyn Warren, Brian Rosen, Panasonic Australia, Australia Post, Carrick Hill, South Australia, the South Australian Department for Environment and Natural Resources, the Botanic Gardens of Adelaide, the City of Adelaide, Royal College of Music, London. Poem, To Jim, by Catherine Susanna Pritchard, used with kind permission of Rick Throssell. A Touch of Elegance, used with permission of SAS Channel 7, Adelaide. Music. With a Girl Like You, written by Reg Presley, copyright 1966 Dick James Music Limited, performed by The Troggs, 1966 Mercury Limited, London. Why Do They Doubt Our Love, written and performed by Johnny O'Keefe, copyright 1959 Victoria Music / MCA Music Australia Proprietary Limited, 1959 Festival Records Proprietary Limited. Polonaise in A-flat Major, opus number 53, composed by Frédéric Chopin, performed by Ricky Edwards. Fast zu Ernst, scenes from Childhood, opus 15, composed by Robert Schumann, performed by Wilhelm Kempf, 1973, Polydor International GmbH, Hamburg. La Campanella, from Violin Concerto in B minor by Niccolo Paganini, transcribed for piano by Franz Liszt, performed by David Helfgott. Hungarian Rhapsody No. 2 in C-sharp minor, composed by Franz Liszt, performed by David Helfgott. Flight of the Bumblebee, composed by Nikolai Rimsky-Korsakov, arranged by Sergei Rachmaninoff, performed by David Helfgott. Gloria, RV 589, composed by Antonio Vivaldi, arranged by David Hirschfelder and Ricky Edwards, copyright Polygram Music Publishing / Mushroom Music. Sospiro, composed by Franz Liszt, performed by David Helfgott. Nulla in Mundo Pax Sincera, composed by Antonio Vivaldi, arranged by David Hirschfelder and Ricky Edwards, copyright Polygram Music Publishing / Mushroom Music, performed by Jane Edwards, soprano, Jeffrey Lancaster, harpsichord, and Gerald Kuhnemann, cello. Daisy Bell, composed by Harry Dacre, arranged and performed by Ricky Edwards, copyright Mushroom Music. Funiculi Funicula, composed by Luigi Denza, arranged by David Hirschfelder and Ricky Edwards, copyright Polygram Music Publishing / Mushroom Music. Prelude in C-sharp minor, Opus 3, No. 2, composed by Sergei Rachmaninoff, performed by David Helfgott, 1994, RAP Productions, Denmark. Symphony No. 9 in D minor, Opus 125, composed by Ludwig van Beethoven, arranged by David Hirschfelder and Ricky Edwards, copyright Polygram Music Publishing, / Mushroom Music. Appassionata Sonata No. 23 in F minor, Opus 57, composed by Ludwig van Beethoven, performed by Ricky Edwards. Dolby. Developed and produced with assistance from the South Australian Film Corporation. Script developed with assistance from the Australian Film Commission. Developed with assistance from Ronin Films, Colour and Movement Films, Great Scott Productions, Roadshow, Coote and Carroll Proprietary Limited, and the New South Wales Film and TV Office. Developed and produced with assistance from Film Victoria. While the characters David and Gillian Helfgott are actual persons, this film also depicts characters and events which are fictional and which do not and are not intended to refer to any real person or any actual event.